Okay, but I figure that before we actually get to the topic, because we had to vote on it also, I'm like, there's ants, like, attacking here. Okay, anyways, this is a fun cheer I give every so often, but I think it's a good cheer to give before we start researching, because it highlights to me what is one of the thorniest issues in PSOC. And that is that text is, by definition, ambiguous. And this creates a real problem when you're trying to poskin and make decisions, because even if you have authoritative texts, if you think the texts are ambiguous, so figuring out what those texts mean is hard. And I don't just mean, like, you have a complicated text and, you know, it might go one way, it might go the other way. You could, you know, it has nuance. I mean that sometimes text in the hand of the right interpreter can easily be made to say opposite things. You know, Nechama Leibovich is said to have once quipped, right, that in the hands of the wrong person, right, the Aseret Hadibrot could be read very differently, because all you have to do is read them rhetorically. Lo tirtzach, right, you shouldn't murder, right, lo tignav, right, I mean, there's literally nothing. If you want to, you could read any text, however, and the reason I think that's important, first of all, it reminds us how much flexibility you have in text. The second is to remind us that to pretend that the halachic texts constrain us automatically is dangerous, right? Meaning we are constrained by the texts, but to think that because we all speak about, you know, similar canonical texts, that there's a limit to what can be said, is to forget that that's not necessarily the case, because the range of what can be said on any given text is so wide. And that reinforces, for me at least, one of the key factors in PSOC, which is integrity. Right? If the text can't constrain you, then you have to trust the people who are reading those texts and interpreting those texts to be doing that with integrity. And what I put here is some extreme examples, just because I think before we start analyzing texts with an eye towards making decisions, I want to remind you how difficult it is to conclusively prove anything from any text at all. To start with, here's a Gemara which Rabbeinu Tam really hated and basically denied that it said what it said. But this is a Gemara in Sanhedrin that reminds you of what I just said in perhaps, at least read simply, the starkest of ways. So who wants to take the first source? There's two lines here in Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Yud Zayin. Go ahead. Okay, so what does that mean? Right, Moshivin meaning just from Yoshev. We can't appoint, right? We can't have someone sit on the Sanhedrin. Unless he knows. So litaher is to declare pure.
Unless he knows how to, like, declare pure from impure.
So it's unless he knows, unless we don't put someone in the Sanhedrin unless he's capable of explaining why a sheretz, which is a impure, not kosher, creepy crawler, is in fact kosher, is in fact tahor. Now, what's the obvious problem that Rabbeinu Tam asks? I didn't even give you Rabbeinu Tam, but it's an obvious question.
Cannot be
done. Yes, correct. It's just wrong. Right? It's just wrong. And then the Gemara goes on, and Amar Rav, Rav says, Ani adon b'tarenu. Here's my argument. Uma nachash meimid umar bet tumat tahor. If a snake kills, and therefore increases tumah in the world, and yet it is tahor, sheretz she'eino mimit, a sheretz which does not kill umaribet tumah, and therefore does not increase the prevalence of tumah in the world, eino din shehe tahor, isn't it pure? More answers for Loi. It's not true, obviously. A snake is just like a thorn, right? Meaning it's not the fact that it makes things tummy. It's not because it's a super tummy. It just happens to be able to kill, right? You wouldn't say the same thing about a thorn, right? It's just it happens to be able to kill, and therefore the fact that it can kill and therefore create tumma has nothing to do with its own tumma and tara status. Now, Rabbeinu Tam really hates this Gemara. Or denies its simple read, because he says, well, I don't understand. What is the value of pilpulim shel hevel? Right? What is the value of someone being able to really cleverly explain why something which is not tamei, something which is tamei isn't in fact not tamei? It's just wrong. Like, it's very nice that you can adduce logical arguments for why that should be the case, but it's not the case. So Rabbeinu Tam says, what's the value? And he reinterprets the Gemara. But what's the simple read of this Gemara? Why would you say that someone who wants to be on the Sanhedrin has to be capable of explaining why what is kosher is not kosher, what's tameh is tahor? Yeah.
I mean, maybe just the idea of being, like, you're capable of doing this, and, like, you're capable of logical reasoning, but, like, you still understand that the base rule is that it's just not the case. So, like,
right, meaning
still
it's
go with that, even if you have, like, a logical argument.
Yeah, so it seems to be that there's this balance. We want someone who understands that there is no, we want someone smart enough to understand that logically there is no constraint to what you could say if you're smart enough. But to recognize at the same time that not everything that could be true is true, and to be constrained. Right, but you see that the way the Gemara phrases it is that they have to be capable of explaining to you why something which is wrong is in fact right. Now this is very dangerous, right? There's a cynical joke that goes around universities that consistently the most immoral base professors on any faculty are
the professors
of what? Of ethics. Why? Because they can literally justify anything, right? You spend all day explaining both sides of every ethical issue, so you can always explain why something is moral, right? Or immoral. You know, if you want to be an extreme Ayn Rand-esque philosopher, so you write a book called The Virtue of Selfishness, right? And you basically say that straight up selfish hedonism is a virtue, right? You can come up with whatever you want. But if you don't just admit that, right? So what the Gemara is getting at is, first of all, in order for someone to be on the Sanhedrin, first of all, they need to understand. They need to be smart enough to be able to see that every legal argument can go in multiple directions. But they need to do that because if they don't recognize that just because something could be argued as true doesn't make it true, and there are constraints, but those constraints are internal from your own integrity and not from the text necessarily, then they're not going to be good, right? They're not going to be wary enough. They're not going to have it. They're not going to be careful enough on the Sanhedrin. But the Gemara is telling you how malleable texts are if we expect a posek to have the mental capabilities of explaining why yes is no and no is yes, right is wrong and wrong is right. So what I just put on this sheet are just really a collection of some of my favorite examples. They're from a variety of places in Shas, but I just think they're good examples which highlight this point and just sort of show how flexible texts can be, so that you're on guard or you're ready for the possibility that just because two of you are looking at the same text doesn't mean you're going to come to the same conclusion at all. So, because it's today's Daf Yomi, which wasn't really planned, but as I was going through the Daf, I remembered that this was in fact today's Daf. Why don't we start with one from today's Daf? Okay, turn the page to number 12. I don't know if any of you do the Daf. I know you started. Okay, good. So for the people who are doing the Daf,
haven't done it yet today.
Okay, good. So we'll think about the Daf for a minute. This is a wonderful little anecdote. Okay, So, why don't you take it? Take an advance, number 12.
No. No, thank you. Do
okay.
It.
No. Okay, fine. I'll tell you the following. It's a story. Rabbi Yossi Haglili Havikazil Barucha. Rabbi Yossi was walking on the way. And Ashkeche Lebruria. So while he was walking, he met Bruria, right? The famed, brilliant.
Oh, is this the one where she says, like, you shouldn't be talking to me?
Very good. Yeah, it's a great story. Two-liner. Right, the famed sage, Bruria, the wife of Rabbi Meir, Amarla. So he said to her, Beida derech nelech lalud. Which way should we go to Lud? And he asked for directions. Amrale. So she said to him, Glili Shota, you idiot Galilean. Lokach amru chachamim altar basicha ma'isha. Didn't the sages say that you shouldn't talk too much to women? Haya lechalomar be'eza l'lud. You should have said, Lud where? Right? Or something. Right, I guess that captures the English translation of that. Right, Be'eza l'lud. Okay, good. Very good. Two-liner. What conclusion do you learn from this Gemara?
Don't make unnecessary conversation with women.
Good. So one possibility is to take this Gemara very literally. And that is the position that the Magen Avot of the Rashbates takes in number 13. Commenting on the Mishnah that Bruria is commenting on, right? Al tarbe sicha emai isha. He says, Al tarbe sicha lazir shelo yavo anichnasin b'veito litbatel midivrei Torah. Don't speak too much to women. Because it warns you that it'll lead to bittul Torah. Shazu mitzvah baba veira he shim yarbe aniyem b'toch beito. Right, so this is even with anybody. And then in the next paragraph he says beishto, right? This is even with your wife. Amru v'shnayim p'nimo matzad beishto nida. Beishto dehora b'mneishes v'atam b'divei Torah. Right, even if she's not a nida because of bittul Torah. And the next paragraph, he says, "Kal vachomer beishel chaveiro." For sure, you shouldn't speak to someone else's wife. And then, if you go to the third line, he says, "Ulefi perushenu yoter pashuta kal vachomer shemishto tehora asur larbot sicha." If we say you shouldn't talk too much to your own wife, even when she's tehora, kol shkem beishel chaveiro. For sure, it's someone else's wife. But lo ribui mamash asur. And then he says, Ribui doesn't mean a lot. Doesn't mean don't be garrulous. Ella afilu teva yetera asur. Even a single extra word is forbidden. What's his proof? Kemasher gata Bruria. Like Bruria said. Right? Altar pesicha ma'isha. Right? She said, Beida derech nelech lalud. And responded, Be'eza lalud. So, you tell me. Is the Magen Avot a fair... No, let's try that again. A possible read of the text.
Yeah.
What type of read is it?
It's very literal.
Yes, it's a hyper-literal text. A read of the text. Very good. Right? So, you can easily see how someone would read this text and come to that conclusion by reading literally. Right? So, I want you to understand that right now, if we're going to offer any other interpretation, what are we doing?
Contradicting this guy?
First, we're contradicting the Tashbates, but methodologically, right? What is our assumption about this text if we disagree with the Tashbates?
That it's not meant to be read literally.
Yeah, right? This isn't just a question of interpretation. This is from one extreme to the other. Is it literal or not literal? That's it. Well, there are a bunch of other stories there, and Bria is very sharp in general, yes.
She's just like a sarcastic, witty person. Like, in the
good! But what's the meaning of her statement?
Maybe she's like critiquing society.
Oh, good. So what's she doing?
She's saying like, you have ridiculous expectations about how you talk to women.
Good. So right, Benny Lau basically says a version of what Brooke said here, which is, she's... Right, this isn't really her saying you shouldn't say an extra word, right? I mean, he has a particular spin on it, which maybe you agree with, maybe you don't, but his read of it goes something like this. Bruria is this great sage. She wants to be treated as such.
Yeah.
But here, she finally, right, she's about to, she, one of the leading sages of the generation, Rabbi Yossi Aglieli, comes and approaches her, and she's like, oh, look, Rabbi Yossi Aglieli is going to come. He's going to engage me in conversation about substance, like, you know, he would any other sage. And what does Rabbi Yossi Aglieli do?
He just asks for directions.
So Rabbi Lau says, oh, she's frustrated, because what does she say?
If
you're going to treat me like the person that I am, the sage that I am, great. But if you're not, you're going to ignore me, right? You're just going to ignore the fact that I'm a sage and ignore the opportunity to speak to me in Torah like you would if you happen to run into a male sage. So then, you know, limit your speech as much as possible. I have no interest in basically being treated as just someone to provide directions, right? If you want to talk to me, and if not, don't.
Yeah, right. Also, if you pick up the Beitel Torah aspect of this part, it could make what she's saying.
Sure, right, you could definitely add the Beitel Torah.
Like, if you're not going to talk about to me about Torah, then just...
Right, you could definitely say that. My preferred read on this Gemara is slightly different than that, though I'm not married to it, but it is my preferred read on it. And that is, it's not how many words that she says, that he says, there is in fact one word that he says that is extremely inappropriate, which she picks up on, which is what I think...
What, Nelech?
Yeah, why Nelech?
Do we go?
Yeah, they're very good. Right? He didn't actually ask for directions. He said, in which way do we go to Lud? Now, that's actually a very inappropriate question. Right? She's not going to Lud, and why is he inviting, right, somebody else's wife, right, asking directions by inviting somebody else's wife to take a long stroll to another city with him, right? There may, and what her statement may be is more, Chazal say, limit discussions with women because it might lead to something inappropriate. Inviting someone else's wife, you know, with no background, candidly, on a long trip to another city is in fact inappropriate, which might lead to her to her outburst. One way or the other, I think that there's good reason to believe that the Taj Bates' uber literal read of this Gemara is not pshat. But it's a good example because it shows you that the halachic implications of this agadic statement come down to not how do you interpret it, but very simply, are you willing to read this literally? Do you feel compelled to read it literally? Even in agadic text, which in general, right, he makes two big leaps. One is that it's literal, and two, that the agadic text is halachic.
Yeah.
Right? There are so many reasons you could not make that radical read. One, you could say it's agadic, so take light, right, lighten how much weight you give it. And then there's all these, you know, other literary or, sociological reads that we're offering, whatever you want to say we're offering. But it comes out from, again, not just a question of how exactly to interpret it. It's, is this literal or completely not literal? And that's a big difference, right? That's a big difference.
I feel like both interpretations are literal. It's just like, are you taking a literary analysis approach or are you taking a deriving
fine. Approach? They're not... Okay, we can quibble about word literal.
I just think like the way he's reading is like he's seeing this agadic story and he's deriving psak from it versus like seeing this agadic story as an agadic story. Both of those sound very literal to me.
Okay, meaning one of them is not deriving any halachic implications or
not any.
Not any. Fine, it's not.
I don't know.
Right, meaning the literal read of her story is four words is more problematic than two.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, but let me show you an even more extreme one. I guess. So go back to number three. So this is a Gemara that appears in several places in Shas. It's in the context of Onat Dvarim. Well, really, it starts in the context of Onat Mamon and then spills over to Onat Dvarim. So what's Onat Mamon? Deceitful overcharging. Right? People sometimes say it's overcharging. That's actually wrong. Onat Mamon is not overcharging, it's deceitful overcharging. Right, not deceitful overcharging is not ona'ah. Right, it may be something else, but it's not ona'ah.
What if like everyone understands that if you buy this product from not like a wholesale marketplace, there's going to be a markup on it.
Right. Right. That's there's a d'oraita problem of Onat Mamon, which is often conflated with a d'rabbanan problem called Hafkat Sharim. Hafkat Sharim is price gouging. Right? And market and price manipulation. Onat Dvarim is overcharging. Right? Deceitful overcharging. Those are not the same. Right? Because price gouging is, I'm not overcharging you in the sense that I'm actually charging you the correct price. It's just that I drove the price up to a point where it shouldn't be. But right now, this is now the market price. Right? Ona'a depends on market price. It's not deceitfully overcharging for market price. Hafkat Sharim is a problem on manipulating the market. Okay, but the Gemara derives, and in addition to Onat Dvarim, we learn a additional prohibition from Ona'a called Ona'at. Sorry, from Onat Mamon, called Onat Dvarim, which is?
Using your words.
Yeah, hurting people. It's hurting people with words. So, in that context, the Gemara says as follows. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rishon Ben Yochai. Gadol Onat Dvarim Onat Mamon. Hurting people with words is worse than deceitfully overcharging them. Why? First, the textual proof. Shezen emar by onat dvarim, by not hurting people with your words, it says, v'yoreita me'elokecha, fear God. V'zelo emar v'yoreita me'elokecha. And it doesn't say fear God by the context of monetary. Rabbi Elazar omer, zebi gufo, v'zebi mamono. Elazar said, additionally, one hurts someone, hurts themselves, right? The other hurts their money. Rishmul Bar Nachmeni Omer, Zenitan Lishavon, Zelonitan Lishavon. One, you can just return, right? You can, if you overcharge someone, you can just give the money back. But if you hurt someone's words, it's not so easy to take it back. So then the Gemara one ups this and says, okay, that's just true of hurting people with words, bullying or whatever, some whatever you want to call it. But if you embarrass them, it's even worse. Tani Tanik Amedir of Nachman Rav Yitzchak. If you embarrass someone publicly, you cause the color to drain from their face, right? That's the literal meaning of malbin, right? Is to cause their face to become lavat, right? To cause their face to pale. So it's as if you murdered. And Amar Lei Shapir Ka'amar said, you're right. The chazina lay the azil sum kavadi chavara. You know that because the blood literally drains from their face. There's a physical component to embarrass it. Amr le abayler of dimi b'marava b'maize. Here, what are they really careful about in Eretz Yisrael? Amr le b'achver ape. They're really careful not to embarrass people. The Amr of Chanina, because of Chanina says, "I call yordim legehinam chutz mishlosha." Because everyone goes to Gehenna except for three. Hakol sad gadaita. You think everyone goes to purgatory? No. Eleima call yordim legehinam olim chutz mishlosha yordim ein olim. Everyone goes to Gehenna, but most people get out. But there are three groups of people that never get out. They stay there for eternity. Who are they? Ve'elohein, Habal Ishidish, an adulterer. Amal bin p'nei chaveiro barabim, someone who embarrasses someone publicly. Ve'amechanesh imro l'chaveiro, and someone who gives someone a bad nickname. Mechane hainu malbin, isn't giving a bad name embarrassing. Where it says, Even if they've gotten used to it by this point.
Wait, what?
What's going to hell, y'all? Did you not know about that?
Well, I just disagree with their definition of nickname. It's not the definition
of nickname. Someone telling her I don't like it, she keeps saying it.
No,
I think
that is so not
hell.
True. You're fine with it.
That's not true. She says she doesn't like to look every day.
No, only when I'm in the presence of other people.
Okay, I literally said it's acceptable in the presence of other people, but then you did it anyways.
No,
because you didn't care.
Oh my god.
Nonetheless.
Well,
yes.
You can draw your own halachic conclusion, though I think the conclusion is pretty obvious.
I'm not going to Gehenna.
Well, just because you
say
that doesn't make it true.
Well, it's
going to
be true.
Okay. And then he adds, Noach lo sheyavo al savei geish deish v'alben p'nei chaveiro b'rabim. It's even better to enter into a case of doubtful adultery than to embarrass someone publicly. And then the Gemara proves this from David. David says in very poetic language, you would know that if right? You cut me at this point, I wouldn't bleed, right? I've been embarrassed so much, the blood is gone, right? I'm dead. Even when I'm dealing with complicated halachic issues, they say to me, David, they taunt me and say, David, what's the punishment for an adulterer? And I tell them, an adulterer, you're right, gets killed. But he'll have a portion in the world to come. But people who embarrass people publicly, they have no portion in the world to come. Amar Marzutra, Amar Tuvia Marav, Amar Rachan, Amar Bizna, Amar Shum Chasida, Amar Rachan, Amar Shum Rechai. And then it concludes it. Noach lo lo adam she yapil atzmo l'toch kivshan ha'esh, v'al yalbin b'nei chaveiro b'rabim. It's better to throw yourself into a fiery furnace and not embarrass someone publicly. Minolan, where do we know that from? Mitamar. Right, from Tamar. Because of the story of Tamar, someone remind me of the story of Tamar. Very good. And then what's for Chazal, the critical moment is that at the moment when she could save her life by saying, Yehuda, you're the father, what does she do instead?
Whoever is the father
comes out. Whoever happens to own these, that's the father. Meaning she gives him an out rather than outing him herself. Which ostensibly put her life in danger because he could have had her killed before the truth came out. Okay? A similar midrash, Amar of Shmuel Bar Nachman, the Sakana Gedol Yard Yosef, Shemargu, Achav, Embriya, Baolam, Makiro, Baolam, Amar, Otsil, Kolish, Mealai, Lakach, Amar Yosef, Bilikom, Utav, Jerog, Baolam, Ayesh, Anachai, Mifneya, Mitrim. The midrash says the same about Yosef. The Yosef waited to kick everybody out. All the Mitzrim out to reveal himself to his brothers. The Gemara said, why isn't that dangerous? Right? For him to be alone with people that he's been accusing and threatening to enslave. Right? Why would he kick everybody else out of the room? Isn't that a bit dangerous? And the Midrash says, well, yeah, Yosef said, I'd rather die. I'd rather risk my life than embarrass my brothers. So I'll wait for them to be gone to reveal myself. Okay. So, in this Gemara, embarrassing people is equated with murder. The Gemara then has a prescriptive statement that it's better to throw yourself into a fiery furnace rather than embarrass someone publicly. So, very simple question. You read this Gemara. Is embarrassing someone publicly a cardinal sin? We have one vote for yes. Good. Support. Why would you say yes?
Because it's better for you to die.
Very good, right? It says it's equivalent to murder. It says throw yourself into a fiery furnace rather than embarrass someone. That's called being a cardinal sin. Okay. Anyone want to vote for no? Yeah.
I'd say it's more of like a philosophical underpinning than like a cardinal sin because like...
Very good. Right? The alternative is to say, no, it's a
philosophical like... and moral argument.
Yeah, it's a philosophical moral hyperbole.
Like, you can't...
Yeah.
Same thing with Lashon Hara, then.
Yeah, same as Lashon Hara. Very good. Exact same as Lashon Hara.
You can't, like,
right, the Gemara by Lashon Hara, which says that Lashon Hara is equivalent to Gilarai Tri Chadam and Avodah Zarah. Same type of thing.
How come you stay in Gehenna if you have, like, committed adultery or, like, embarrassed someone?
It's not a bad thing. I every time someone asks me about what happens in Gehenna, I check out. I don't know. Hey, whoa. The Gemara never said murder was fine. That never came up in any Gemara, right? The Gemara is indeed employing...
Why is someone not on this list? You're blatantly not listening to them and disregarding everything that has to do with their own being.
I tend to think that, yes, this is hyperbole. And in hyperbole, right, it's not as important to state the obvious. Right?
So, there are three things that you wouldn't think there.
Well, embarrassing people publicly happens all the time. Giving people nicknames happens all the time. Even adultery, right, which is generally understood to be bad, though I guess not so much in the 21st century, but probably not Chazal was a given. Still, right, there's always counterarguments like, right, well, it's a dead marriage, right, whatever, right, love trumps all, I don't know, right? Who knows? Right, in the Greeks... in the Greek philosophy, in the Greek tragedies, right? Love is enough to wage wars. I don't, you know, you have things. You can have justifications. Okay. So I want to show you just how far the Rishonim take this Gemara in the two directions. So there are two major Rishonim who agree with Abigail and say, yeah, it is in fact Yehar Gvel Yavor. Tosvot and Rabbeinu Yonah. Tosvot says in Sota Daf Yud, V'nira haidlo chashiv le b'hadei shalosh averot. Right. Why is this not mentioned as one of the big three? Right, that's a good question as to if this is a cardinal sin, why doesn't it get listed in the Gemara, which has three cardinal sins? So Tosafot says, "She'enam d'vigoach nefesh, avod go chavim gilarad shuchadamim." Right, idolatry, sexual prohibitions, and murder. Yishum naver al banapanim in a mefurashet b'tarav alonoket ela averat mefurashet. So Tosafot says something shocking, which is that when the Gemara says there are only three sins which are cardinal, it meant three sins that are explicit in the Torah. But Onat Dvarim is a derivative. It's not explicit in the Torah. We derive it from Onat Mamon. And therefore, it is Yehar Gvel Yavor. It is a cardinal sin, but it doesn't get counted in the three because it wasn't explicit. What's...
I don't like its reasoning.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
So this is a... Textually, fine, it works, but it's so logically problematic. Why is it logically problematic?
Because you can say, oh, anything, I'm just deriving that's a cardinal
sin. Right, first of all, you could say about anything, and I would say even more.
I mean, because the Torah wasn't listing examples, it was listing exclusives.
Yeah! And I would say even more. If I had to guess which things are Yehar Gvel Yavor, right, are cardinal.
There are things that are written in the Torah.
Yeah, very
Torah.
Good. If I had to guess, it would be things in the Torah. To say, oh, no, there's a lot of things that are, like, implied by the Torah that are also cardinal sins, but they weren't important enough to get any space in the Torah. They just happen to be cardinal sins. Right, that is a very weird construct. But it is a very weird construct. But that tells us his understanding. Rabbeinu Yonah has a different conceptualization, and that is... In number 6, Vine avak ratzicha halbanat panim. Very simple. The Ron writes that the three big sins aren't sins, they're categories of sin, and therefore there are subsections called abuzrayu, right, derivatives. And he says, public humiliation is a derivative of murder. And therefore it is counted. It's not an independent sin, it's a derivative. Because it's sort of like murder, right? Murder, you know, you shoot someone, their blood gushes out onto the floor. When you embarrass someone, their blood drains from their face. You know, similar. But that's his conceptualization. So here we have two major Rishonim who, in both very creative reads, say, take this Gemara and say, yes indeed. Embarrassing people publicly is Yehareg Val Yavor. Now, look at the Rivash, number 7. This is a Tshuva Rizkub Rasheshet, and he writes as follows. Lo Amru Bosh Yehareg Val Yavor Kmo Botan Shalosh Averot. We do not say it's Yehareg Val Yavor like murder, sexual prohibitions, and idolatry. Now, if you just said that, if I stopped there, I'd say, okay, fine. Tosfot and Rabbeinu Yonah say it's literal, and they come up with clever ways of reading it. And he says it's not literal. That would be one thing. It's his next line that highlights just how flexible texts can be. Vizeh lo ala al da'at shum adam. The fact that these should be a cardinal sin, what is it? Zeh lo ala al da'at shum adam mean?
Well, you have to be an idiot to
think. It's more than that. No one ever thought this. Right? Not as you shouldn't ever think this, as no one has ever thought this. Ever.
Well,
velo chashav enosh. No human being has ever believed this. Ever. Ever, ever, ever. Ella. It's just that the way of sages is to express sins hyperbolically. So that people won't sin in them. Like, as Abigail said before, we do by Lashon Hara. Right, that's his example. So here, what do you have? You have two major Rishonim. Look at the Gemara, and they say, hey, the Gemara seems like it's saying that embarrassing people publicly is a cardinal sin. That's weird. It goes against the Gemara that says it's only murder, sexual prohibitions, and avodah zarah. Big deal! Right? I will take the Gemara literally. I'll either come up with the novel idea that murder, that embarrassing people is a subset of murder, or the even more wild idea of Tosafot, that there are three cardinal sins that are explicit in the Torah, but then there could be a bunch of implications that are also cardinal sins. They just weren't important enough to make it into the Torah explicitly, but they are cardinal sins, right? Which is a wild, wild read. And then at the other extreme, you have the Rivash, who not only does he say, I disagree, he says, it never happened. It's never happened. No one ever thought that. No one will ever think that. That's patently absurd. And here's the question I would pose to you. Can you prove that either one is right?
I don't know how we can even make the assertion that, like, no one ever thought this.
It's a rhetorical device.
I know. But
yes,
like,
it's a rhetorical device, talking about rhetorical advice. But I want to ask the question very pointedly. Looking at this text, can you prove conclusively, dispositively, that who's right? No, because it's not a question of how to interpret a text. It's literally it's a question of, everyone agrees what the line says. The question is it literal or hyperbole? And the nafkamina to that question is it literally a cardinal sin for which you have to forfeit your life? Or is this just hyperbole and it has no halachic implication whatsoever? That is about as extreme as you could get, right? From saying, this is a prohibition which is not explicit in the Torah, but we want to talk about it hyperbolically, so we say it's really, really bad, to saying this is up there with murder, and if someone held a gun to your head and said, I will shoot you if you don't post something insulting on Facebook about that person, you actually should take the bullet to the head, right? That is Tosva, right? That being the range of how to interpret this text just highlights how malleable a text can be. And I would point out that, now, if you look at in number 8, the Meiri just says that it's derech tzachut. It's an expression, right? But lest you think that this dispute stayed in the time of the Rishonim, I'll tell you, even in the 20th century, this was a machloket. And a posek, one of the most important poskim of the second half of the 20th century, if not the most important Israeli posek of the second half of the 20th century, Shlomo Zalman Orbach, in Tshuvat Mincha Shlomo Chelek Aleph Tshuva Zayin, in fact, paskins like Tosafot, and says, yep, embarrassing people publicly is Yehari Bel Yavor. That's it. We paskin like Tosafot. And what's his reason? Because he says, look, it's Tosafot Ben Yona against the Meiri, essentially. So, Tosafot Ben Yona, Meiri, Tosafot. That's it. And then he expands it. Now, you want to understand what's at stake here. He says, not only that, but wait a second, if it's Yehari Bel Yavor, so should we entertain the possibility that if someone is running after someone to embarrass them, so they're a rodef and you should kill them? Can you be Machal Shabbos to prevent someone from embarrassing someone publicly? Right? All these are open questions for him. Because if Tosafot is right, so then it's equivalent to murder. If it's equivalent to murder, so then maybe it's like Rodev. Maybe you can be Machal Shabbos. Right? That's what Shlomo Zalman Orbach. It's not like, right? And the other extreme, Rav Henkin writes a very long tshuva in B'nai Banim, and he says, are you out of your mind? Right? Are you absolutely crazy? And he says, what are you telling me it's Tosafot and Rabbeinu Yonah against the Meiri? And he just lines up like 50 other Rishonim who agree with Meiri, and he says, I mean, it's a weird Tosafot, but you can't seriously tell me that this is halacha. Now, there are other possibilities, right? I'll throw them out outside. It's possible there is a general machloket between the Rambam and Tosafot. The Rambam believes that The three major sins are the only sins for which you're allowed to give up your life. The other 610 mitzvot, even if you wanted to, you couldn't give up your life rather than violate them. You're obligated to save your life. Tosfot thinks that there are three mitzvot in the Torah for which you are obligated and 610 for which you have the right to give up your life if you so choose. But you're not obligated. So it is possible that, right, there are several reads that you can offer in the Achronim, such as maybe on embarrassing people publicly, the Rambam would agree to Tosfot, meaning it's not saying you have to, it's just saying you have the right to. Or alternatively, if you possibly like Tosfot in general, that you're always allowed to give up your life if you want to. So the Gemara isn't saying you have to, it's just saying no achlo, that you always have the right to give up your life rather than violate the Torah. But when it comes to embarrassing people publicly, you don't have to, but this isn't neutral, right? It's we would encourage you to do that. I once heard right, Clapper suggest as a theoretical possibility that maybe the Gemara is saying it hyperbolically to get across that in certain circumstances where it's not just like a one-time humiliation, but where you know that by doing something you will ruin somebody's life forever, like irreparably ruin their life, that the Gemara is giving you the option to not do that by sacrificing yourself, which if you want an example of what that looks like, there was an excellent article in First Things two, three years ago or so by Helen Andrews called Shame Storm, about how many decades it took for her to escape a video posted by her ex-boyfriend of accusing her of being like a narcissist or something like that, and how much it dogged her and prevented her from getting jobs and followed her even when she moved from America to Australia, and even after she got married and changed her name to her husband's name, it still managed to follow her and affect her life for decades. So, you know, it could be that the Gemara is saying, look, you're not obligated to, but understand that there are certain very extreme scenarios where maybe you might actually want to entertain the possibility of giving up your life rather than destroying someone else's for the long term. That's, another theoretical possibility. But again, this is, right, just an example of the type of flexibility that you have in text. Okay, let me give you at least one more example. So look at number two. Okay? The Taz here summarizes a major machloket between himself and the Tur in basically Kol HaTorah Kula. And that is the following. Many times in Shas, you'll have the Gemara make a comparison. X to Y. Right? X is like Y. So, as Rav Lichtenstein used to put it, every time you see a magic chaf, right, you see the chaf of comparison, what do you have to ask? What's the first thing you have to ask? So as he put it, chaf can mean one of two very different things. In Hebrew, he put it as chaf ha-dimyon, v'chaf ha-shivyon. The chaf of equivalence, or the chaf of comparison. Meaning, is X ki Y, meaning X equals Y, or X ki Y is X is like Y in a certain way? The Tur and the Taz argue about this in every single place that this appears in Kol HaTorah Kula, and that, trust me, has a lot of nafkaminas. So, look. He writes, HaTur Siyem Sh'aviv Mivio L'Chayolam Abba, Rabba Mivio L'Chayolam Abba, sorry, L'Olam Azeh, Rabba Mivio L'Chayolam Abba. The Tur finishes Hilchot Kibud Av V'Em by saying, your parents bring you to this world, your teachers to the world to come. V'Ein L'Cha Kavod Kavod Rabba, Umara Kimara O. There is no honor as great as honor of your teacher, or awe as much as the awe of your teacher. V'amru chachamim umora rabcha kemora shamayim. And the sages say that the fear of your teacher should like the fear of heaven. V'hikshe b'prisha. The prisha said, imkein mayoter me'aviv. V'gam b'aviv katav rabbeinu. D'chvod amora k'chvod Umara Hashem, then in what sense is the fear and honor of your teachers more than your parents if both of them are equated to the fear of God? V'teretz, the kolamukesh, ene shavah legamrei, elamakesh, mashen kemar rabcha, kemar shamayim, gashum in Hashem, elokech atiro, l'rabot rabo. So he says very simple. Chaf usually means it's like in a certain sense, but it's not equivalent. And therefore, right, you can't say, oh, X equals, right, X equals Y, and X equals, and Y equals Z, so, right, X equals Z, right? It doesn't really work that way. These are comparisons, we're saying. You know, it's an expression, it's sort of like it. But you can't draw firm halakhic conclusions because these are similarities, not equivalences. And the Taz writes, V'lo nihira, it's not true. Divada komidid hukers l'chaver, aminim chilo klal. Wrong. Anything that's equated is, anything with a chaf is equivalent, not similar. Now that's a major machloket, and it's not just one little machloket. It's literally a machloket about one letter that changes potentially, I don't know, tens of halachot. Do you think that chaf is similar or equivalent to? And I don't know if we have time to read it inside, but if I gave it to you in the summary in 19 minutes, it's really yes, there. Here's a nafka minute to that question. The Gemara says that kol hamagadel yatom b'doch beido kilu yelado. If you raise an orphan in your house, it's as if you gave birth to them. Okay. So, do you fulfill the mitzvah peruvu of procreation by adopting? Most poskim will tell you it's a beautiful mitzvah, but it's not. It's not procreation. It's not a substitute. You can't choose, unless you have very good reason, right, to give up on the mitzvah of having children because you want to adopt. And yet, Rosh Shlomo Kluger, in his first siman in Shulchan Aruch, says, no. It says, kol magadel yatom b'toch b'do ki ilu yelado. And therefore, he says, you do. Now, he has a little bit of a weird formulation. He has this novel interpretation that in order to fulfill the mitzvah of procreation, it's not enough to have children. You need to also be engaged in the procreative act. And therefore, he thinks that, but in a weird way, right? He doesn't actually think that you need to procreate naturally, right? Because that would mean you have to, right, actually have sex and have a child from that act. He just thinks you need to have children and to at some point engage in the procreative act. And therefore, he says, you fulfill the mitzvah peruvu if, at some point, a couple is together, and they adopt children, so they did the act, and they have the result, even though the act and the result are unrelated. Which is a very weird, it's a very weird conceptualization of the whole mitzvah, but that's not really the point of this. The point is simply that here, the Tzitz Eliezer says, whether Shlomo Kluger is right or not hangs on what question? The machloket between the Prisha and the Taz. That if you hold that whenever the Torah compares X to Y, it means it literally, so then adoption is compared to having children, so by adopting you fulfill the mitzvah peruvu. And if you think that adopting, then you think that chaf is kaf ha-shivyon, dimyon and not shivyon, it's similar to but not necessarily equivalent, so then you don't. The entire machloket comes down to a meta machloket about how to understand one letter. And again, can you prove who's right? No, because this isn't a local machloket. It's not a localized question, how do I read this Gemara? It's a meta machloket about how you read all comparisons in the Torah, in Chazal. Every time the Chazal compares something with the letter Chaf, do I have to assume equivalence, or can I assume similarity? And again, all these are just examples, and you know they're sort of scattered around Shas. But the point of bringing them is, as I said, what I want to show you as we sort of start actually researching after Sukkot, when we have uninterrupted months of learning, which we don't have now, hopefully uninterrupted, I don't know. But Sukkot is Sukkot, and no one remembers anything after Sukkot. It was like, you know, like when I gave Shir at Migdal, when I knew Yom Kippur was coming up, I'm like, I have to finish today, because I don't want to have to repeat literally everything we did, right, after 5 days of break. It's not worth it. And definitely a once-a-week shiur after a week of Sukkot. Like, we should start when we have a chunk. But what I wanted to do before we actually jump into the text is to just recognize that the reason I expect that we're going to look at the same texts together, learn the same topic together, but there's no reason to assume not only that you have won't have the identical opinion by the end of this, but that you might end up having diametrically opposed positions, is to realize that's just inherent. Right? Texts are ambiguous. And if that's true of a single text, when you have a topic which is complicated, with many different facets, obviously, you could look at the exact same material, you could study the material together, but in the end of the day, what decision you make comes up to not, there is no right or, right, there's no definitely right or definitely wrong. Texts are flexible. And you need to be braced for that when you learn a sugya, especially when you're learning it with an eye towards coming up with your own decision. Because in the end of the day, if you think that you can use a text as a crutch, right, you can say, well, in the end of the day, I'll be able to bolster everything with text. Yeah, you can. But bolstering something with text is not the same as proving it. Right, you can support it. You can say, I think this is the most plausible read. That's why I'm convinced by this read. But if you think you're going to be able to bludgeon someone into agreeing with you because you have a text, these sort of extreme examples to prove to you, that's not happening. Right? Texts are, by definition, subject to flexibility, to meta-assumptions about how you read, right? And then you have to interpret. And then you have to look at the history of interpretation and the authorities. And then you have to take into account minhag. And then you have to take all those into account. That makes psak really, really hard, really, really messy, and is why you should expect as a given multi-vocality and a variety of opinions. Okay? So, as we go into these experiments starting after, so because I want you to be braced for that, I want you to think about that, and then we'll start actually tackling the topic when we come back. Okay? So with that...